Good evening. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club and this Bay Gourmet program, Farm Together Now, Portraits of a New Food Movement. I'm Rosie, Program Director for 18 Reasons. It is my pleasure, really my deepest pleasure, to introduce Anne Hammersky, who's becoming quite a friend and also a wonderful local photographer and storyteller. Anne and I have worked together a couple of times now, and it's with true delight that I get to share this evening with you and her and Amy. Anne Hammersky is a visual storyteller whose portrait, documentary, and multimedia projects capture the humanity of those who shape the social and cultural landscape of our times. Her work has been supported by the Walter and Elise Haas Fund, Sierra Club Foundation, Cliff Bar Family Foundation, Soros Foundation, and the SF Art Commission. She has exhibited her work at venues including the Oakland Museum, Open Society Institute, Southern Exposure Gallery, and Prague's FAMU. Her photography has been published in numerous magazines, including Life, Time, Newsweek, National Geographic Traveler, Savoir, Gastronomica, Mother Jones, and Vanity Fair. Farm Together Now is her second book published by Chronicle Books. It's also my pleasure to be at the table with Amy Courtney, also becoming a friend. I just moved to the Bay Area, so people are becoming friends. Freewheeling Farm down in Santa Cruz has been a great asset to 18 Reasons as we increase our farm programming, and they have a really wonderful collaborative structure that you'll hear more about tonight that I think can inspire a lot of hope and encourage us all that it is possible to be very much involved in the farming, sustainable farming community. Amy's a real joy. She's a wit. She might get on the table and dance for you, but she definitely has a lot of words of wisdom. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. Please welcome Anne Hammersky and Amy Courtney.
Well, thanks. Is this on? Thank you, Rosie, for that great introduction, and thank you, Amy, for driving up from Santa Cruz, our surprise guest here, and thank you, Bridget Flanagan, for having us here tonight, and the Commonwealth Club. Very much an honor to be here in this historic and venerable location, and thank you all for coming tonight on such a gorgeous evening that you're coming inside to watch some slides, so thank you. So, this is my heartfelt, juicy heirloom tomato shot that says thank you to you all for coming. So I just wanted to give you a little bit of background on myself. I'm from Nebraska, and how I got into photographing food and farming issues for the probably more than 10 years now. And back when I was a kid in Nebraska, I was a member of 4-H, and that certainly continues to inform my work now. Head, hands, heart, and health. And we can talk about that at length, you know, and what that means to all of us. But for me, it definitely is in my roots. And I was thinking back on, like, how to describe one of my friends, Tao, actually said, how did you get into this? And I said, well, let me think. And back in seventh grade, I read Diet for a Small Planet, and that's how I kind of got politicized around how food really does affect the environment. And so I kind of wanted to kind of give a shout out to that book. And then we're fast forwarding through quite a few years of photography and getting more and more into food and farming. And this middle shot is a shot of Amy when we first met down at Eco Farm. And so through the years, I've done a lot of different work on food and farming. And then this book that we're talking about tonight is written by Amy Franceschini and Daniel Tucker. And Amy is the woman in pink there. And she was the giving you a little bit of background on the book and how the book came about. And she was the brain, the Victory Garden Project downtown and throughout the city was essentially Amy Franceschini. It was her idea, and she's a local artist who actually has a very international reputation for conceptual art, and her work is fantastic, and she's been a fabulous collaborator. And anyway, this was part of – how many of you folks here saw the Victory Garden Project downtown? Yay, it was really, really awesome, wasn't it? And so – Chronicle Books approached her after that project, and they said, we want you to do a Victory Garden book. And she had already basically done that at Gallery 16 with Griff down at Gallery 16. So she said, I don't really want to do that. And they said, well, what would you like to do? And she said, well, I would like to do, this is Daniel in the corner, and then Amy in the middle are my wonderful collaborators. By the way, I'll just insert that Daniel Tucker is an activist and editor and writer in Chicago. And anyway, Chronicle went and, you know, they said, well, what would you like to do, Amy? And she said, well, I kind of am envisioning a textbook on the what different projects are going on around the country, solution-based stories to give people an idea of what's, you know, kind of a cross-section of the diversity of what's going on in the good food movement, in the sustainable ag movement. So anyway, they called me in. I'd worked with Amy on the Victory Garden project and with Blair Randall at Garden for the Environment. Some of you may know him as well. Anyway, we worked together. And anyway, they brought me, Daniel and Amy brought me in and said, well, we have these, we'd like you to photograph the farms on the West Coast and for this book. And I said, I would love to. It's this heart's desire. You know, this would be fantastic. I would like it so much that I would like to shoot all the farms across the country. So we kind of made that work. We, you know, crunched the numbers and labor of love later, you know, it's like, you know, got to travel the country. And this is sort of a statement of sort of intent for the book. It says, by understanding how these individuals are creating solutions for their lives and the lives of those whom they care about, we feel more optimistic about our future. We present their stories here because we know that a new food system can only emerge if the diversity and complexity that these folks embody are part of the discussion. So we have a really diverse group of people in this book, and I hit the road, and this I'm calling into the room one of my heroes and influences, Dorothea Lange, and she was a San Francisco portrait photographer who also went around the country shooting agricultural stories during, you know, I'm sure you've all seen her pictures, but I call her into the room as a San Francisco photographer. My roots as well. So sometimes I traveled with Amy. This is Amy, and sometimes I traveled with Daniel. A lot of times I traveled by myself. We had a very short deadline and a lot of farms and a lot of miles to cover. And sometimes I traveled with my son, Joey, and he was a great assistant. And I tracked how many sunsets I was going to be at different places, and how many sunrises I was going to be at different places, and really kind of fit the puzzle together. We had, a really tight deadline and 13,000 miles to cover and 20 farms to look at in about 3 months and deal with, you know, who's going to be home, who's going to be harvesting, what's the weather going to be like, what's in full bloom, that kind of thing. So this was one of my first spots, and it was on, I want to start introducing you to 5 different folks in the book. And this first slide is Devin Pena, and he is a scholar and a farmer. And he, this is in southern Colorado. He calls it northernmost reaches of Mexico. And it's very much like New Mexico more than Colorado. And what they have there is that he has a group called the Acequia Institute, and he funds research on this particular kind of a cultural, it's just like the kind of the land that time forgot in a way there, because this system of agriculture and this system of irrigation has been going on there for centuries. And this valley, the San Luis Valley, is kind of like a baguette that's been chopped in these small little pieces, not small pieces, but like a slice of bread, and people work these slices of this valley, and then they bring the water, this gravity-fed, you know, water comes down through these acequias, these canals, these ditches, and then they stop them with these tarps, and then they move the water by hand into the fields as you can see here. That's Devin in his friend Joe's field. And they use the water like a community resource. It's not a commodity. And they share the water, they share equipment, they share labor, they share the vega, all the cows. Anybody who owns a cow there can bring the cow into La Vega and they can graze freely there. Now I'm going to take you over to Atlanta, Georgia, and to the Georgia Hunger Coalition, a very different approach to the changing the food system. And these fine women here, they started as a nonprofit that basically was a clearinghouse for information on food stamps and how to change the food stamp system, and people would call them up. And the story goes that they got into actually producing food because one time this woman called them up and said, "So where's the food? You know, you're the Hunger Coalition, so where's the food?" And they said, "Well, ma'am, we can, like, tell you about information about where to get the food stamps and where to, you know, blah, 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 blah." And she goes, I don't want, you know, information. I want some food." And so they decided to change their program, and they partnered, or to add to their program, and to partner with African American farmers and buy food from them and create a market for these African American farmers down in the South, and then they give the food away, or they sell it for low prices, or, you know, people can use their food stamps for the food, and they do a really great service there. And at the end of a hot, sweaty day of documenting their work, Althea Morrow and her daughter and some of her other kids, we had some fun with just the end of the day portraits. So that's sort of how this one came about. I'm going to take you now over to Appalachia and Burnsville, North Carolina, and to Mountain Garden Herbs. And this guy, his name is Joe Hollis, and he is an amazing person who knows so much about medicinal herbs. And the Appalachia, maybe you guys know that it's like an abundantly rich ecosystem for medicinal plants and rare plants. And Joe knows. I mean, he really knows a lot about it. And he's been there. He calls it paradise gardening. And he does, it's called Southern Ginseng. And it has the same compounds, the same medicinal compounds as Asian ginseng, but they don't have to dig it up. They just chop up the leaves, and it has, from what Joe says, it has even more of these compounds than the root. So I mean, it's just this. This is one of his. He's really famous for this, and what he has done is he has helped the tobacco farmers in his area switch over to medicinal herbs, and he has a pharmacy, and he does tinctures, and that's his value added are his herbal remedies. And I have a funny story to tell about this guy. A lot of times I was traveling, you know, by myself. This was one of the times I was traveling with Daniel, one of the writers, and Joe and he had a great conversation, a great interview all day. And I was walking around the garden and shooting all day. So I had a tiny bit of light left, and I'm like, I need to do my portrait. You know, I want to do my portrait. And Joe was pretty tired by then, and you know, he's getting on in years. So I basically just had to kind of chase him around. And at one point I said to him, so wait a second, Joe, hold on. So, like, what's your favorite? What are you most proud of right now? What are you most excited about? And he goes, in one word, he goes, wasabi. So I said, well, show me the wasabi. So that's that really beautiful, you know, dark green stuff in the foreground is his wasabi field. And apparently it's very difficult to cultivate. And he's done a really, this year he really, it really latched on. So this is Joe Hollis. Now I'm going to take you up to the Hudson River Valley. and to introduce you to Sam Comfort. And he is a young beekeeper who's had tons of experience in the commercial world, moving bees around from North Dakota to California, almond fields and everything. I mean, he has seen the conventional side of beekeeping. And one of my favorite quotes in the book is from Sam, and he says, you know, bees have always been, they used to be divine creatures in every culture except ours, and now they are just livestock. And, I mean, there's a whole lot I could tell you. You know, we could talk about bees and the colony collapse disorder. And one of the things that Sam does, and he swears by it, is that he his bees are strong. Oh, I have a couple stories to tell you about Sam. But one of the reasons that his bees are so healthy is that he allows them to build their own comb. And, you know, the bees just, they don't, conventional bees are, they build their comb off of like a petroleum-based kind of prefab, I don't even know what they're called, but Sam's don't do that. He just has these top loaders, and the bees just, they just exercise themselves kind of more, so they're hardier. And one thing, if you'll notice, he doesn't have a bee suit on. My son and I got out of the car, and Sam met us in his truck, and he had this kind of crumpled little white pile of fabric, and he's like, here, do you want to like wear a bee suit? We're going to go out to see some bees. And I was looking at him, and I said, well, Sam, are you going to wear a bee suit? And he goes, nah, I never wear a bee suit. And I said, well, why should I wear a bee suit? Joey, you want to wear a bee suit? And Joey's like, I don't want to wear a bee suit either. So here he is out. I call him like the barefoot beekeeper, and he's like got his muscle shirt, and he's in his flip-flops, and you know, he's like definitely messing around with his bees, and they are not buzzing one bit. I mean, not one bee landed on me. They're really happy bees. And what he's mostly about, you know, is raising bees not so much for their honey. I mean, he takes a little bit of honey, but he leaves the honey for the bees, and he is really interested in growing in, I don't know, cultivating. What do you do with bees? You raise them, you keep them. He raises them for the queens. And just is doing a big service for all the farmers in the Hudson Valley, which is another hotbed, like the Bay Area is a hotbed of, you know, alternative and sustainable and organic ag. Same with Hudson River Valley because of, you know, the New York City market. Anyway, so Sam is just doing a great job there and teaching a lot of people about how he's doing it. So we love Sam Comfort. So now I'm going to take you to my last farm here and introduce you to Jim Knopik. And Jim is one of my heroes. All the people in the book are heroes to me. I mean, farmers these days that are trying to do something different, they're all really moving towards, you know, solutions around, you know, climate change and getting away from conventional ag, or as we like to call it, chemical ag. And Jim was, for many, many, many years, was a conventional farmer. And I find his story interesting because he has made the switch to sustainable. And here he is with his son and his grandson, and they are in the last field of soybeans. They're organic soybeans, but he's moving away from feeding his animals any kind of, he's, you know, moving completely to 100% grass-fed, and he's got one of his very last center pivot behind him. And when I was in Nebraska doing a Q&A a couple months ago, and I had Jim come out and speak with the audience, and this slide came on, and I said, well, Jim, how was it for you? Give us a little rundown on what it was like to switch from conventional to organic. And I was just expecting him to tell some stories about this and this and this. I was sort of prompting him. And it actually choked him up, you know, and he couldn't speak any further. And I think he's from Nebraska. He's in the middle of Monsanto land, ConAgra land. Mm-hmm. He is, you know, going totally against the grain. What politicized him is that the big CAFOs were coming into his county, which are the confined animal feeding operations. These big hog confinements were coming into his county, and they were pitting farmer against farmer and family against family and trying to kind of wheedle their way into the county. And Jim got some of his hit. Like on Friday night, he talked to two of his neighbors, and they said, "Well, let's get together and figure out what we want to do about this." They were open-minded, actually. And by Sunday night, they had contacted a lot of their neighbors. By Sunday night, they had like 150 families, and they all kind of got together and did a lot of research. And they said, "You know what? This is absolutely not what we want to do with our county." They changed all the zoning laws. They created this Mid-Nebraska Pride. They got really organized, and they kept the CAFOs out of their county. And here he is with some of his dirt hogs, and his grandson's dirt hogs. And you know, he after that experience with these keeping these big confinement operations out of the county, he looked at his own conventional ag practices, and he said, "You know, I was walking around with a syringe in my back pocket in order to keep these confined animals." He had smaller confinement, you know, barns, but they were still, nonetheless, you know, he was seeing things in a really different way. And he said, "You know, I'm walking around with a syringe in my pocket, and you know, how am I really any different from these big operations?" So he took a really good hard look at his work, and he switched over. And this is like his land. He took it out of corn and out of soybean production. He turned it back into prairie, and this is his. He's still in transition with it, as you saw with that other slide. This is him and his son and his grandson again, and they are moving their cattle. They do what's called mob grazing or rotational grazing, and it's a super fascinating way of having very healthy land. He is rebuilding the prairie in 2 years. He's built 4 inches of sod in just that amount of time, which retains water, which, you know, no runoff. Like, his ponds never fill up anymore. His neighbor's ponds always fill up from runoff of water. His on and on and on. His cows, because he moves them with these electric fences, he moves them and they, let me just go back here. I mean, just the prairie is like being reborn there, and it makes so much sense there for so many reasons, not just for the land and regrowing the sod, as I said, not just for the water quality and retaining the water, not just for the cows, because they're eating all sorts of different grasses and weeds, and the weeds actually have more protein than the grass. I mean, just these, they're getting a bigger, more abundant, kind of diverse salad bar, and so they're healthier. They're like incredibly docile. Again, just like Sam's bees, they're like, this is a wide-angle lens. I mean, I am so close to this cow, and there's also at the same moment, there's a cow that's breathing hot air down my neck, saying, "When are you going to move away from that patch of my favorite weed, you know, that my favorite grass?" I mean, they're just surrounding me. They're not afraid of me at all. If any of you have ever been in a feedlot, you know those cows, they jump as soon as they see a human. Not these cows. Very, very at home on the prairie here. But the other thing that is a real benefit for this kind of grazing there is that the land can sustain four times the cows. Four times the cows. So that's sort of you know, he has literally crossed the road to the other side. And this is, I'll leave you with this. One of my favorite pictures from the book is this one. So, you know, I just wanted to say that, like, this book is called Farm Together Now because it's, like, very much a diverse group of people and stories. And, you know, we've got, you know, vegan people in the book that are doing work and organic milk farmers, ranchers, and people who are doing raising market vegetables, and backyard farmers, all kinds of ways to be a part of this movement. We've got, you know, people who are hermits and doing good work, and people who live in intentional communities. And we've got just the Cathedral of the Barn people. I don't know what, you know, one of my favorite pick. This is a good story behind that. I'll maybe share that with you if you have time. And people with, you know, family people, just, and, you know, really it's all about good food for all of us, and healthy, safe, good for the environment, good for the soul, good for the community. And I just wanted to say, you know, lastly, is that we live in this amazing city, San Francisco, that has so many ways that if any of you are, I call it buy curious. It's like, okay, you're like, you buy the organic food, and now you're kind of curious to get maybe a little more involved. And it's like, it's like there's so many ways to get involved in this city. And I just wanted to share with you, like, the San Francisco Urban Agriculture Alliance, and there's the website up there, and it's a portal for, like, I don't know, 20, 25, 30, 35 different groups. And if you just go there, there are links to, like, all these other groups, and 18 Reasons is probably on there. If you're not, join up and get your website on there. Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's just so many ways to, like, pitch in and do so many different things going on. And because we are like a hub of activity here, and we are one of the shining beacons for this movement here in San Francisco. And so what I want to do now is I want to introduce my personal farmer and my dear friend, Amy Courtney, and want to thank her so much for making the drive up from Santa Cruz to be a part of our program tonight. And she's going to show some of the slides I took as a part of this book, because Freewheelin' Farm is one of the chapters in the book, too. So I just wanted everybody to give a big, big hand for strawberry-bringing Amy Courtney.
I've seen Anne's work a lot, and I'm always amazed at what I haven't seen, and it's always so inspiring. And I'm just having a moment right now of just feeling really lucky to be included, not just in the book, but in this family of people that are doing this kind of work around the country. I'm like, yeah, beautiful people, and then, wow, there I am, and there's Daryl and Kirsten. We're a part of this, you know, so thank you for bringing that family together. It's really important. I love this picture. This is a good one. And I think it kind of expresses, I didn't know that this was going to be her intro in, but on the drive up here, I was trying to think about what is the nugget of what's valuable about what Freewheelin' Farm is doing. And I'll go through some slides, and you can see how we do what we do. We approach things in some different ways. But I think at the core of it, and hopefully you'll hear this through the presentation, is that we're striving to create a good livelihood for ourselves. And that is the art that we're cultivating for ourselves so that we can grow ourselves and grow our community through the vehicle of food. And I think that's really what's at the core of what's happening at Freewheelin' Farm. And we happen to have amazing lettuce, strawberries, and potatoes as well. So, okay. Great. So this is the beginning. This is Little Brassica Starts. Okay. Well, little surprise. Okay. I just wanted to talk about who we are. So, there's Kirsten on the left, myself in the middle. They're cracking me up, or Anne is, or both. And Daryl Wong on the right. And to speak to that under core, I think the reason why we work so well as a team is that we all share that belief that what we're doing is beyond beets and carrots, that that's just the vehicle of making a beautiful life for ourselves and our community. And I think that's the thread that keeps us together. So we're a three-person partnership, which is not always easy, but it's always interesting. And it really forces us to ask a lot of questions of ourselves and make sure that we're doing something the right way. So it's not always the fastest way to do something, but it's often the most smart and efficient way for us to move forward with something, to check in with all three of us. How's that direction look? How's that direction look? And it's an interesting model that's coming up a lot in our community. There's about three other farms that we know that organically, not because they wanted to be like Freewheeling Farm, started doing three-person partnerships. So it's an interesting model for kind of this age group, 30s, 40s, farm set. And we're proud to have two ladies in our threesome. And in this family of farming, I do just want to acknowledge that we kind of represent this, like, return to farming. We're all college educated. We all had ants in our pants while we stood in lecture halls, and we wanted to be outside, and we all wanted to help the planet, and we all wanted to address food issues, from labor to food access to nutrition and on. Yeah, so we've come back to the earth, and I know there's been a lot of writing about this, but I want to acknowledge that that's sort of our little niche that we're holding down here, and there's a lot of us out there, thank goodness, because I think we're a big part of the future of our agriculture. So we started with a half acre and all hand tools and $1,500, and we had 10 members that first year. And now, okay, there's the me part, there's the Kirsten part, and there's the Daryl part. Everybody looks so happy. And now we have 7 acres and 2 tractors and a beautiful ocean view. So we've really been growing over the last 9 years. So we've been doing this for 9 years, starting to get the hang of it. Just want to point out that white stuff right there is row cover. Recently, we met our formerly conventional Brussels sprout growing neighbor, who is now converting to organic. And he's in this interesting place where he's sort of substituting organic pesticides for what were his synthetic pesticides. And he said, well, what do you guys do? What are you spraying? And I scratch my head, and I realize we haven't sprayed anything in 8 years. And the first year, we sprayed some soaps. But this row cover is what saves us. We just put a physical barrier over most of the crops that we get pest problems with. So we're really just putting the seeds in the earth, trying to tend to the soil, and growing healthy plants. And that seems to be working. So our main marketing outlet is through CSA. Does everybody here know what CSA is? Anybody not know what CSA is? Excellent. Thanks for your bravery there. It stands for Community Supported Agriculture, and what it means for us is that 100 households sign up to support us and the farm every year for the harvest season, which in our case is 6 months. Every week, we bring them a mixed bag of whatever we've got on the farm. So I think this was week one 3 years ago, a mix of what we were bringing out. And we are doing 100 households this year in Santa Cruz and San Francisco, and hope to keep growing that. We also do restaurant sales and a little bit of wholesale. So here's some sexy veg shots. Beautiful work, Ann Hammersky. Little onions, little harvest. So this is a little walk through a day in the harvest life for CSA. Do some, go out in the field in the morning, bring everything in, bring them into the washroom, scrub everything up, make them look all pretty. Arugula, yay, what victory. And then we do this wacky thing that gives us our name, Freewheeling Farm. We load everything up onto bike trailers. I think, there we go. And we bike all of the produce into Santa Cruz, about 5 miles from the farm. We run 4 routes into Santa Cruz every week doing that. And then we also drive up to San Francisco, and someone meets us here and then does bike delivery throughout San Francisco. And this originated because when the farm started 9 years ago, I didn't have a truck. I had $1,500 and no truck. So it made a lot of sense at that time with 10 members. And each year as we grow, we ask ourselves, does this still make sense to do? And so far, it does. It's fun. We have a lot of volunteers who come and do it. In fact, Daryl, Kirsten, and I haven't taken a single load in this year because we have so many volunteers who want to do it. And I just think to myself as I see them off the highway, if we were driving this stuff into town, nobody would show up to do our deliveries. So it's a really nice little bonus that took 8 years to cultivate. But yeah, and it's just a nod to the petroleum use that happens in agriculture. Agriculture is actually the second largest consumer of petroleum as far as industries go in this country, and the largest usage of that is in transporting the food from farm to consumer. So we're probably not going to save the world, but maybe a little chunk of the Arctic glaciers. And it's just a little nod that gives us a little moment to talk about that and to understand that. And it's a fun way to do it. It's actually not that hard. And I always like to say that people, you know, divorce their husbands and quit their jobs so that they can bike down Highway 1. And we just get to do it once a week just for fun, you know. So, and there we go, setting off. There it is. Woohoo!
Is that heavy to pull?
Oh,
that looks like a big
load. It can weigh, not this trailer. This is a trailer that we've since retired. We found that in a trash heap and revived it, and it ran for 7 years, but now we're on to the bigger ones, which there's one, the front one is one of those, and it can carry up to 500 pounds. We've not pushed it over 300 just for our own sanity, but at 300 pounds, it actually is very doable. You can see that neither Kirsten nor I are the Incredible Hulk. Mm-hmm. We don't have amazing bikes either. We're not like super bikey, geeky. We'd like to be, but we're not. We're too busy growing carrots. And it just pulls. Yeah, wheels are amazing, amazing inventions. And, you know, people like to gawk and say, what the heck are you guys doing? It's kind of fun. And then we bring all the produce into town and we set up a little mini farm stand. It's kind of where we meet the community. And we let our CSA's members know which items they can pick up. And, you know, 2 pints of strawberries, a bunch of kale, and so on and so forth. And kind of present it in a way that they're kind of picking through and choosing. Sometimes it's this or that. There's a little trade out. So, yeah, it's kind of like our own little mini connection with our members. And it's an opportunity to check in and let them ask about the farm and get some sense of what's going on out on the farm. I'm not sure where the slides are going. Okay, here we go. And every year we have an art party out on the farm, and it is kind of our big thank you to the community. We feel like the farm is this, there's just this reciprocal energy that keeps us going, and we want to thank our community that supports us. Without that, there's no reason to be doing what we're doing. And so we invite artists like Ann Hammersky to come out onto the farm and use the farm as their canvas and display works in a way that incorporates their vision with what we're doing out on the farm, music, food, and just a fun time. So keep your ear to the ground on that. Let's see. Where, yeah, there's another. And there we are. Yeah. I just want to, again, say just that farming, like life, is really, it's just about the connections that you make with the people that you work with, the people that you invite onto the farm, the people that you serve the food to, the people that are inspired by the farm because they've heard about it, and so on. So thank you for showing up tonight and hearing about it and letting us make some more connections. Appreciate it.
thank you. It's definitely humbling to follow two such impressive and inspirational women. And I don't grow food, and I haven't traveled the country to make sure that this movement is documented, which is extremely important, so that there is this textbook out there. If anyone like you or myself wants to start, we can get this inspiration. So thank you very much for your work is where I'd like to begin. Thank you. And I wanted to start, I'm going to ask just one or two questions and then open it up to the audience in this about 15 minutes we have for Q&A. And I wanted to start with an arts-related question. And when you guys look at the book, it's available outside, you'll notice that it's extremely diverse. Like if we go back to that first quotation that Anne put up, that was the manifesto for Farm Together Now about preserving the diversity of what's out there, it's represented in the book. There is the hermit, there's the collaborative biking food, there are economists, there are people who grow for the sake of growing, there are people who grow for the sake of building community, there are nonprofits, there are for-profits. And in my background in the arts, what I saw so strongly in the book, or could recognize so strongly in the book, was that with that diversity, you managed to create a coherent aesthetic within the book. And I think that's a really interesting challenge for storytelling. The book, for you guys I don't know, is it's interviews and then it's the visual story. And I'm wondering if you can talk about the reasons or how you do that. How do you create an aesthetic coherency between such diverse stories? And how do you make each one of those incoherency, that diversity, still shine?
That's a great question. I think it goes back to just really, you know, every artist has their own vision of the world too, you know, and we're all unique individual people and our voices are different. So I think, and our eyes are different. So I think as a photographer, you know, my eye, I couldn't really see it any other way than how I do see it, you know, and how I frame it and how I interact with people. Mm-hmm. And so I think that there's a through line with the book because there is one photographer essentially. And so I think that was one of the reasons why when I did say, hey, I do want to do all these farms, they kind of scratched their head and they said, well, you know, it would kind of make a cohesive visual feeling to the book as well. So that makes sense to us as well as your desire to do it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's just sort of an underpinning of my camera, my lens kind of like, and I think too, just the approach that I have to all the different people is one of like really deep respect and deep curiosity, and that's kind of a through line as well, and to really try to understand and what are the high points to really tell your story, that your unique story, and then follow those rivers of curiosity to create the photo that would tell their unique story, but tell it through a lens which would give it the cohesiveness.
You sort of then answered the second question, was how do you tell a visual story? So I'll skip that one if you guys are okay with it. And Amy, I wanted to ask you a question, is that why do you think within the sustainable food movement there is such a diverse approach? Why do we see that?
Another good question. In truth, I think in all agriculture, there's so much diversity. I always say for every farmer, there's two ideas of how you can do something. So you can imagine having two partners, three of us, there's like six ideas of how to approach something at any given time. I mean, there are so many ways to approach every single thing that you do on a farm that it's not the least bit surprising. I think it's way, way more in line with art than science. There's certainly soil sciences and there's, entomology to be aware of and botany to be aware of. And really what pulls a farm together is the art form of finding your path. And so I think, yeah, for every artist, there's going to be lots of renditions of how to go about it.
That's a beautiful answer. I was expecting something about the monotony of conventional agriculture, and I got pure poetry instead. Like I said, it's humbling to be up here. So I wonder if any of you do have questions, and we'll take We have a microphone, so you just ask it directly.
Hi, Amy. I'm wondering what your background is. You said you graduated from college. And then I was also curious about your partners, what the three of you sort of bring to your business that are different, and sort of what their backgrounds are.
Yeah, great question. I'm a college graduate. We're all college graduates. This is the ways that we're similar. We are all from suburban-ish bedroom communities. Kirsten's from the East Coast. I'm from the Midwest, and Daryl's from the West Coast. So that's kind of a nice little, like, actually gives us a broad. We do harken back to like, oh, actually, in Missouri. Let's not do it like that. On the East Coast, there's some really nice models of small CSA farms that Kirsten actually weaves into our understanding of what we're doing in that context. And of course, Daryl has a lot of community and connection and historical knowledge of this coast and what's been going on here and the way of agriculture. But in terms of the day-to-day, I think we're still finding where we all plug in concrete ways, but we do, as a matter of efficiency, take certain tasks and we divvy up our work. And so we're tending to shine in those areas because those are the pieces that we've decided that we want to do just by selection. And then there's a few of the outliers that nobody wants to do when we divvy them up amongst ourselves. And within that, I think we're finding, we've been working as a threesome for 4 years now. We're finding where the pieces click and fit and where they don't. And so it's a work in progress, like everything else. But I would say that Kirsten is definitely the strong bottom liner of like, how to from A to B and how we're going to keep the records on that. Real kind of linear approach that we need. And we come back to needing those records all the time and are so grateful for that contribution. Real strong attention to detail she has. And then Daryl is just like a wonder child who can problem solve anything. I mean, farming in my estimation is nothing but a series of problems arising and you just tackle them, and kind of nothing scares him and nothing's too much. He'll figure it out. And I think that's one of his really strong suits, but the list goes on under that category. It's, you know, computer and, you know, website design and accounting and on, he's a whiz. And, I don't know. You get to decide what I do.
Thank you. I think I was wanting to hear a little bit more specific, because you're talking about college educated, one East Coast, one Midwest, one California, wherever it is. I'm thinking more specifically, because I'm thinking just in my own Delta Informal Gardeners in Brentwood, California, our current president is a UC Davis graduate, working on her dad's acreage. I don't know if it's under 20 or over 40, whatever. But I was just talking with her Monday, and she said, believe it or not, Vivian, I majored in art history. And this is what I think we find, you know, a little bit more specific, because you have all these character, these qualities, but sometimes what intrigued you in college and others, and how you made that shift and what brought you together, not just because you had college degrees. Right. That's what is a little bit more curious to me personally anyway. Thanks.
Great. Yeah, sure. I'd love to flesh that out a little bit. Kirsten and Daryl both studied environmental studies, and I studied basically environmental studies, but they called it community studies at UCSE. And I think we all came into agriculture actually for a lot of the same reasons. We've spoken together to lots of groups and are always trying to come up with things that the other person didn't just say. But it's, you know, concern and love for the earth concern about questionable or downright nasty labor practices in agriculture, concerns about petroleum consumption, concerns about access to food and nutrition, and all of these were things that our liberal arts education exposed us to, and we were all wondering what we could do about that, and we all had a love for being outside and working with our bodies. And we found each other through the Center for Agroecology and Sustainable Food Systems, which is the anchor of where we all got trained in our agriculture. Each of us had done some work on other farms, but it was pretty marginal. So we went through the CASFIS, for short, program, and did the apprenticeship program there and came out just ready to go for it. So we've been layering ourselves into Freewheel and Farm after that education and met through that vehicle. And that's the bulk of our education, and it's the bulk of our community. We have a large, large network across the country that we can rely on, that we have Google chat rooms with, so we can ask questions. And it's an ongoing educational resource for us to be connected with that. Does everybody know about the Center for Agroecology Sustainable Food Systems? It's at the base of UCSE. And it is, like most UC programs, getting severely hit by budget cuts. It's kind of been, if I may, the bastard child of UCSE for many years, and they've been kind of cutting it back. And it's a beautiful 25-acre farm that does an amazing job of teaching farming and gardening skills to about 30 apprentices every year. So they've been doing it for 35 some odd years. So it's starting to add up, the number of tentacles. I'm going to guess that on your journey, you probably ran into quite a few apprentice graduates.
Yeah, it's definitely made its mark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I hope that helps.
Though,
I'm not familiar with that. When was that? It sounds like it might be different. This is right up at the base of UCSE. Yeah.
It is. The Rocking R is what.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. There you go.
In gray.
Hi. This is fascinating, and I love the concept of art and farming. I'm an artist, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your art party down in Santa Cruz and how that works, and if it's by invitation or how the art thing works.
Fundraiser, $200 for an afternoon, whatever.
Well, we ask for $5 to $20 sliding donation to come in. It is a fun and fundraiser for the farm. It was an inspiration by a mutual friend of Ann and ours and mine, Melinda Lundgren, to bring her passion of art and the farm together. And I happen to live on the farm in a community of artists who aren't terribly involved in the farm. So for me personally, it was a little bit of a merging of those two worlds as well. It happens in the fall. It is by invite or push your way in only for artists, and consider yourself invited as of now. And again, what we really like to see is some tie-in to the farm. Anne has done an amazing job of making the farm her canvas. She's done seed packet-like displays of her photographs, as if they were, you know, like telling you what the next bed was. And then there's the photograph. It's just super lovely. Prayer flags that people can write their wish for the farm that lasted on the farm for about 3 or 4 years and just added so much color and joy.
That was really fun to do. There's a lot of, it's kind of like a mini, almost like a Burning Man down there, burning Ag Man down there. It's a very wonderful Santa Cruz scene. And I would, like, what did we do the last time? I forget. I think I did like a, everybody was doing all kinds
of
things. I did a game for kids, and it was like a hangman for kids where people had to guess. It was more of a performance art piece where the kids had to guess, like, you know, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, or like, you know, don't count your chickens before they hatch. We had these like mottos up that were all ag related kind of things. They were plant related things, you know,
and they'd win like the world's largest zucchini or something.
Yeah. It's just like, yeah. So if you're interested, talk to Amy about
it. Do you publicize it on your website?
We do. We put it on our website and we're now on Facebook. And I do have information cards. They look like this that are out by the strawberries, which please, I'll be so sad if I go home with any strawberries. So please eat them or take them before you leave and help yourself to the cards. And they have our contact info on there. And we can get you on the email list too, to keep you posted about the art party.
We have time for maybe one more question. Is there another question? Great.
I'm just curious, how large the
That's perfect. So I was going to feed a question about hope if no one had a question. Thank you.
I don't really know what the percentage is. I mean, I think that unfortunately, in a way, that it's a very small sliver of the conventional ag has a pretty big stranglehold on our food system. But, you know, we have to maintain hope. I think that organic, sustainable, I think it's around, is it like 1%? Or 2%?
I don't know.
It's a very small percent.
It's lower than 5, but it's growing beyond the 1 at this point.
Okay. And I think that's why it's important for us to just do whatever we can and plug in however you can. And just, like I said, that the Bay Area is like, and the Santa Cruz area, you know, it's one of the beacons, one of the vortexes of the tornado that's like gaining strength. So, you know, yeah, you got to hang in there and keep on keeping on.
Yeah.
Make it 6%, 7, 10%. It's now 15%, 100%.
Yeah. Well, I will say that in this downturned economy, it has been one of the industries that has continued to grow. And women farmers are going off the charts right now, which is kind of exciting. And I think, you know, with the president that we have in the White House right now, and a concern about job creation and the environment and going green, I think that things are getting to a really ripe place. Many thanks, Michael Pollan, Barbara Kingsolver, for kind of bringing this out to the general population, Whole Foods even. People are aware, and I think what they really want is a sustainable, healthy food system. And it's going to take that push from the government helping us out down here. Everybody's just been fighting for scraps. And if we can get some government assistance, some legislation that would ease the financial pangs of what it takes to run a small farm, that we would see a really big blossom and shift. And I think that that could happen in the next 10 years.
Are you familiar with Country Life magazine?
No.
Write it down.
Yeah, you need to know.
Yeah, I'll look into it.
Folks specialize in small farms.
Uh-huh. He's saying Country Life magazine is a good resource.
And they have a radio station as well. If you're not familiar with them, they will probably love to have your farm as one of their articles.
Awesome.
And it's a
Thank
really
you.
Fun community. So, I mean, the hope there is that I think as more people realize that we've been living in some degrees, you know, I sit at your desk, can't wait till your job is over type of lifestyle. Everyone I meet who's in the sustainable food movement is so passionate and fired up, and their life is their job. And there's a real beauty and harmony that forever that's been a farmer's case, but for the rest of the diversity of the system, that your life is your job and you couldn't be happier. I think that's going to catch on also. I mean, and that's where I see a lot of the hope, is that people are enjoying life again in such a really profound face-to-face type of way, where they know their neighbors and they're feeding each other. And that's a really rich experience that I can't imagine will do anything but catch on. So because this was – the book is supposed to be a textbook, I want to make sure we ended by giving you some resources for what you can do and how you can get plugged in. There's a local – blog called Civil Eats, which is a great aggregate that you could follow. They have stories on farmers. They also have updates on policy. They have talks and lectures. So for really anyone, they have different themes, and you could follow the part of the website that you like. The San Francisco Urban Agriculture Alliance is a great resource in supporting their work, supporting city farmers also that now have the right in San Francisco to sell what they grow, which came to pass this spring. So Little City Gardens are going out to Alamein and supporting them. Hayes Valley, that's right here in our neighborhood. Following Mark Bittman in his what he writes on the New York Times, he's a great resource for getting interested in something and then doing some more research on your own. I'd say definitely involve the Farm Bill, which is coming up in 2012. Get really educate yourself. Food and Water Watch, San Francisco Food and Water Watch, does a lot of education on that. As much as it's going to be a future of regional food systems, we live in a really big nation and we need national policy that supports sustainable agriculture. So get behind the Farm Bill. Support your local edible schoolyards. The Green Schoolyard Alliance here in San Francisco that works with San Francisco Unified, make sure kids get their hands in the dirt when they're young and learn how to cook with what they grow, and they eat kale and it's amazing. That's another way you can be involved. QASA, reading their weekly newsletter, going to any of the farmers markets in town. Those are just some ways I feel like you could start getting versed. Grow something. You know, if we live in shady, in foggy San Francisco, but you know what? We grow amazing greens. Grow some parsley. Grow some great, amazing, fabulous chicories. You know, just grow a little something, and then you have that intimate connection that may inspire you more. Support Anne and Amy. Sign up for Amy's CSA. You know, it's not too late. Buy farm together now. Just whatever we can do. Feed your family. Cook. All of those things are ways that you can be involved and that will make a difference. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Anne will be here to sign books if anyone is interested. And all of you will be here for a short time just to answer any additional questions you may have. Okay. Right, and to enjoy the last of the strawberries.
And I need to say officially, I think, with this again, tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation.